In celebration of Black History Month, today's podcast features an analysis of the poem, The Hill We Climb, as presented by Amanda Gorman during the inauguration of Joe Biden on January 20th, 2021, and features Quincy College English professor Steve Dooner as he presents his analysis of wonderful allusions, references, and wordplay delivered during this historic moment.
When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace. In the norms and notions of what just is, isn't always just is. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother can dream of becoming president, only to find herself reciting for one. And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. And so we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first. We must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. Let the globe, if nothing else, say this is true. That even as we grieved, we grew. That even as we hurt, we hoped. That even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together, victorious. Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division. Scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. If we're to live up to our own time, then victory won't lie in the blade, but in all the bridges we've made. That is the promised glade, the hill we climb, if only we dare it. Because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it. Would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated. In this truth, in this faith we trust, for while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. This is the era of just redemption. We feared it at its inception. We did not feel prepared to be the heirs of such a terrifying hour, but within it we found the power to author a new chapter, to offer hope and laughter to ourselves. So, while once we asked, how could we possibly prevail over catastrophe? Now we assert, how could catastrophe possibly prevail over us? We will not march back to what was, but move to what shall be, a country that is bruised but whole, benevolent but bold, fierce and free. We will not be turned around or interrupted by intimidation, because we know our inaction and inertia will be the inheritance of the next generation. Our blunders become their burdens. But one thing is certain. If we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and change our children's birthright. So let us leave behind a country better than one we were left. With every breath from my bronze-pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the gold-limbed hills of the West. We will rise from the wind-swept Northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the Midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked South. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover in every known nook of our nation, in every corner called our country. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning programs to schools, students, and parents. JFY's individualized self-paced curricula help raise individual and school performance measures by maintaining grade-level skills and combating learning loss. JFY provides online ELA and math curricula aligned to the state and college standards from grade 5 through high school, with personal support online and via telephone from friendly learning specialists like yours truly. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Steve Duner has been teaching and performing literature for over 30 years. A favorite professor among Quincy College students, his classes are filled with energy and the passion which Professor Duner has for literature. His professional experiences demonstrate he is not just an instructor of literature, but also a student constantly learning.
I am a teacher, started teaching back in 1987, and I hope I don't look that old, but I have been teaching for 30-something years now, right? And 33 years. And I started teaching in graduate school as a grad student, and I've been trying to get this gig right all these years. I love teaching literature. My field was originally Shakespeare and also Romantic literature and Shelley. Then I got into, but I also love theater. I was always a theater kid. Growing up, I performed on stage in musicals. And then I started doing Shakespeare at an early age. And I really loved, you know, directing Shakespeare over the years, directing plays like Macbeth, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, Romeo and Juliet. Those are all things that I've done. Midsummer Night's Dream 3 or 4 times. So I love directing in the theater. I've written a few plays. Lizzie of Fall River was the play I wrote that about 4,000 people came to see it in 1999. And we revised it a few years ago and another 4,000 people came to see it. So there was an enormous amount of interest in Lizzie as a subject. And it really does just bring in the people. People have now are performing that play outside of my original productions, and I'm selling the play, so that's great. Another thing is I've acted on stage. What else? I've worked as a journalist. I've edited dissertations for books on whaling and books on the Boston mob. I've been a literary student my whole life. I'm devoted to try to crack the nut of teaching difficult subjects to students who are being exposed to this stuff for the first time.
An inauguration is always an occasion for historical moments. But Amanda Gorman's original work may have done more to speak to the moment, this moment, more than any other instance that day.
I think so, because for me, the poem really calls on so much of American history, American literature. It's sort of a mini course in American literature. If you actually look at all the allusions that are present in the poem, it's it evokes very powerful voices in the African-American experience, but also, I have a list of all the kind of influences right here. There's obviously a connection she feels to Phyllis Wheatley. She proposes a new muse in the New York Times. It was printed that she wants a new muse to inspire the poetry of democracy. And you immediately think of Phyllis Wheatley's To His Excellency George Washington. But then also she has connections to Abraham Lincoln, to the Gettysburg Address, address and the second inaugural address to the African American preaching tradition, the church tradition of great preachers like Martin Luther King Jr. Maya Angelou's poetry, Still I Rise, is evoked in this poem, as well as Paul Laurence Dunbar's poem Sympathy, from which the phrase "I've heard the cage bird sing" comes from. She's obviously connected to Def Jam poetry, or spoken word as it's called today, and Saul Williams, and also very prominently printed and spoken about in the media is her connection to Hamilton and Lin-Manuel Miranda. So if you look at that, that's quite an amazing tradition. Oh, and by the way, Phyllis Wheatley, who I mentioned before, is the first poet of the United States, and she was a Black woman who was a slave here in Boston, who wrote some of the most profound poetry of her time. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Gorman was able to incorporate many great moments, great orators, and literary allusions throughout the poem.
Jill Biden first heard Amanda Gorman speak at the Library of Congress, and she wrote a poem about the Charleston riot, and it was called Unite the Right. And it was when she was a youth poet laureate. So Jill Biden is the reason, Jill Biden, the wife of President Joe Biden and the First Lady, is the reason she's become the poet laureate of the United States. This is a position that was held by Robert Frost in the past, and more recently, Billy Collins and a few others. But you know, this is quite an extraordinary distinction. So it's fun to have our first Def Jam spoken word poet who's connecting poetry to a whole new audience. And when you hear a great writer like Saul Williams read a poem like Coded, you can actually hear some of the style. You know, writers like musicians like Gil Scott-Heron and Saul Williams are sort of the basis of the style she's using. So it begins by her saying, and here's the start of the poem: "When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace, and the norms and notions of what just is isn't always justice." Now, there's so much here right in the beginning that she's just throwing at us. Something that everybody should be listening for is the sound shade. You know, the darkness that we're coming out of, and that we've waded in it. She will use words all the way through, afraid, glade, and she's gonna use this aid sound as like a thread. It's gonna be one of the dominant, if it was a piece of music, it would be the dominant tone of the poem. And you can actually hear this aid sound, shade, wade, glade, afraid, listen to it as you go through the poem. That's just one thing. And whenever I read poetry, I always tell my class, stop trying to read with your head. It doesn't work. Read with your gut, read with your heart. Let words jump out at you. You know, too many people try to solve problems like they're a Sherlock Holmes mystery, or like they try to solve poems like they're a Sherlock Holmes mystery or a riddle to be solved. That's not the way poetry works. I liken poetry to going to a museum, like you're walking through an art exhibition and you're drawn to the painting with a lot of red in it, or you're drawn to the painting with a lot of blue in it and you don't know why, and the poem speaks to you. And I think you should think of yourself as walking through pictures at an exhibition or a gallery. You know, that's the way I feel like when I go through a long poem like this. So I'm listening to the dominant sounds right away. And then I notice some really fun language, like, we brave the belly of the beast. That's from the famous mythologist Joseph Campbell, right? That's the dark part of a fairy tale when Little Red Riding Hood has been eaten up by the wolf and it looks like it's darkness. That's when the Avengers have collapsed and failed and they've all fallen apart before they rally in the third act of the movie and come together and defeat Loki. You know, that's this dark moment in a story. And she's speaking specifically about all the beasts we brave, like the Civil War, but specifically the recent riot. You know, that we saw the face of the beast coming into the Capitol. And so that's a very interesting and profound moment. We brave the belly of the beast, and we've learned that quiet isn't always peace. It's not always good to back down. When I heard that line in the poem, I thought of Jonathan Larson from Rent. The opposite of war isn't peace, it's creation. You know, that sometimes there can be an uneasy peace or a dishonest peace, like in the 1930s when everybody tried to appease Hitler and tried to keep the peace, but it only created more violence in the end. And so a quiet peace is what she's referring to here, is it can be a lie. And then she says, that we have to look not for what is. We can't be satisfied for what is, but we have to look for what should be. That's the romantic call. That's the call to idealism, like you find in Don Quixote. Not what just is, but always justice. And that's the first time in the poem that she's going to evoke the famous line from Martin Luther King Jr., his letter from a Birmingham jail, that justice too long delayed is justice denied. And that's a really big idea.
Wordplay is paramount for great poets. And Gorman's playful nature of words added both amusement and meaning for the audience.
And the term for that is a pun. That's the literary term is a pun, where a hard-boiled egg in the morning is hard to beat. You know, that's a pun. And the police were called to a daycare center where a toddler was resisting arrest. They usually make people groan. They're the cousin of dad jokes, but it's a wonderful thing. Her pun here is very beautiful. It's not, and the norms and notions of what just is isn't always justice, not what is, but what should be. So we have to start building the world that should be. And so she starts with that. And then, you know, and she's talking about a lot of the language which America always uses, the dawn, the dawn's early light, things like that. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. Well, this is really awesome. She uses these things called double rhymes, which is the sound knew it and do it. You know, and so you have two rhymes going in two words at the end of a line. And then she uses this thing called alliteration, which, if you remember, is Silly Sally sells seashells by the seashore, or Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, something like that. And she uses this to go from negative to positive. We've weathered and witnessed. You know, we've born and suffered, and then we have witnessed, we're testifying now, and we're coming out of that darkness. And every time she uses alliteration, there's almost a climactic feeling as you get to the end of the alliterative line, and you want to listen for that. That's a really big thing. She, you know, listen for those sounds. And then everybody, all the pundits and all the commentators said that the great line of the poem, which was considered a very healing line for a country that's gone through a lot of division recently, is that this is a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished, the unfinished nation, all right? And that recalls, you know, book titles of recent histories, that we are a work in progress. And that's a wonderful idea. Now we move on again. And this is where shows what's very traditional in poetry, something called apology or humility. You're not supposed to come on all swagger and arrogance. You're supposed to show that you're just a little person too. And that makes the audience more receptive to you. If you come out and say, I've written the best poem ever, people are going, it's not that great. But if you say, hey, I've written a poem, it's terrible. Will you read it, but please don't kill it. People, you will usually say, hey, this is pretty good. So poets long ago realized that it's good to be humble when you start a poem. And so she says, we, the successors of a country in a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother can dream of becoming president only to find herself reciting for one, right? That she's gone from being just the skinny black girl to this woman who is now the poet laureate who can recite at the inauguration. And that is a profound transition that we can all see ourselves in. And that's that humility I was speaking about. And then she starts to get really into it. There's some nice things called allusions. Allusions are like sly references to the past. You got to be hip. You got to be hip to get them. You know, if I say that you had as much fun as four lovable mop tops from Liverpool, well, that would be an allusion to the Beatles. right? And so for me, you make these references without quite coming out and saying what you meant. So you want to start listening for these allusions. And the first one is, and yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose. Now, the allusion here, it's from Madison. It's from the preamble of the Constitution. And even Madison spoke with humility that we can't expect perfection, can try to form. And so she says, with humility, again, the beginning of poem with humility, we should not expect to form a union that is perfect. America will make mistakes, and we have to be grown-ups about it. You know, we do have mistakes and we try to fix them, but it's wrong to try to hide from them or run away from them and not to address them. If people are being accidentally shot in the street because police work needs some reform, that's a question that we should raise and talk about. It is not something that we should run away from or hide from. And so she is saying, no, we will never really be perfect because that's only in heaven, but we can strive to forge a union with purpose. We can let that purpose inform all of our whole journey, that purpose, that sense of purpose. And in a lot of religious books, like recently, they talk about the purpose-driven life, you know, and people look for a sense of purpose in their lives. So yes, perfection is too far away, but we can try to make a better nation, and we can seek to know our purpose, because it's celebrating what America can do, and also acknowledging, honestly, America's flaws. Then I was talking about the alliteration, the Peter Pepper picked a pick of pickled peppers thing. Here she uses alliteration in a climactic way, and you want to listen to that again. So it builds off what she had just said. She says, we are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. And I really think of the sentences that Lincoln had in the Gettysburg Address when I hear things like that. You know, the way he would use triads. We cannot, a nation of the people, for the people, and by the people shall not perish from this earth. And there's a sense of climax in that line. And you can hear the same climax in these kinds of lines.
Rhetoric is defined as the art of effective or persuasive speaking or writing, especially the use of figures of speech. The weaving of efficacious language by Gorman conjures images for the audience.
And now she gets to something which is a really fancy thing from the old school of rhetoric. Rhetoric is the art of speech making and oratory. You know all about that, Greg. You are a premier teacher of speech and rhetoric. And so this is chiasmus, or the crisscross. And the crisscross is like an X in Greek, is a chi, the letter chi. And these are famous in JFK's speeches. John F. Kennedy is always cited, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, or never negotiating out of fear, but never fearing to negotiate, right? And so he makes these crisscross sounds in the words. And just like JFK in those beautiful speeches, she, Amanda Gorman, says this, listen to it. And so we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. So she rhymes divide and aside, but she goes from a D sound, divide, to first. And then she goes from a first, the word first, to a D word, differences aside. And listen to that again. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. And that's a ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. But it's got a rhyme in it too, which is really cool. So she had a little trifecta there. And then I think so. And you're going to hear this Kennedy chiasmus coming back again later on with lots of other echoes, not only to Kennedy, but also Lincoln, who loved to use antithesis, which is saying one thing and then saying the opposite. And you're going to hear a lot of that. So now my pick for the most beautiful line in the speech is the very next line. And it's because she uses internal rhyme and assonance. Assonance is repeating a vowel sound in a line. Like, it's not quite internal rhyme. It's something like that strange lady made us play great games all through May. Do you know what I mean? And you hear the A. It's not all rhyming, but you can hear that sound. And so here's a beautiful use of the arm sound, like in the word harm or arm. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. And so there's the internal rhyming going on of arms and arms and harm and harmony. And you can actually hear it forming in this beautiful way. And of course, that second line recalls Lincoln's famous second inaugural speech, which a lot of people thought would be called on quite a bit in this inauguration, because it almost felt like we had come through a great civil war with that storm on the Capitol. And so people were looking for Biden, who did actually quote Lincoln's second inaugural in his address. People were listening for that because they thought it was a good speech for the occasion. And the line, we seek harm to none and harmony for all, recalls Lincoln's famous words, with malice toward none and charity for all.
The wit of wordplay continues as Gorman evokes the use of phonetics to continue her powerful message.
Now, there's also some brilliant wordplay in the poem. And you can listen to this. Here she becomes a bit like Shakespeare. And it's fun that she uses the word globe, because Shakespeare would refer to the whole globe in the same way, you know, the Globe Theater. And there's almost a very Shakespearean quality. Shakespeare loved to pawn and to play on words and even flip letters around to create anagrammatical kind of patterns. And you're going to actually see this as you listen to these words. Let the globe, if nothing else, say this is true, that even as we grieved, we grew. That even as we hurt, we hoped. That even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together, victorious. And you can hear the grieved grew, hurt hoped. And those are beautiful alliterations. But it's the next line where she plays with the letters. That even as we tired, we tried. And she just moves the R and tired into just one spot to make it the word tried. And that gives you, go from darkness to hope. You go from death to resurrection in that one switch of a letter. And they really are all the same letters, that even as we tired, we tried. And then she bounces off the sound of the rhyme in the word tried into the next line, that even as we tired, we tried, that we'll forever be tied together, victorious. And of course, this reminds us of a great allusion to Martin Luther King's wonderful letter from a Birmingham jail, where he said that we're all bound together in one network of mutuality, tied together in a single garment of destiny. And so we're all tied together is a great MLK allusion or reference to MLK. Now, she goes on a little bit further here, and you're going to start to hear the aid sound coming back from the beginning. She says, and there's a great reference to the Bible here, to the book of Micah, chapter 4, verse 4. This is an allusion to the Bible, but it's also an allusion to a hit Broadway show called Hamilton, right? And this Broadway show, of course, has George Washington say, I want to sit under my own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. Listen to this. Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division. Scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. Well, calling on scripture recalls Lincoln saying 67 years ago in his famous Gettysburg Address. But the line from Hamilton, which I think you could sing, Greg, right, if you wanted to, everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. We'll be safe in the nation we've made. I want to sit under my own vine and fig tree, a moment alone in the shade. Now, that's her aid sound, but that's happening off the page. And she read this, and she's, you know, the great story about Amanda Gorman is that she had a terrible speech impediment for her whole life and couldn't pronounce the word R. And she said that reciting and learning Hamilton helped her practice her R's and made her such a beautiful speaker. And I think it gives all of us hope. I remember I had a sibilant S when I was in first grade. I said my S's through my teeth, and I had to have speech therapy for a whole year. And she taught me to close my teeth when I said S. And so I really feel that Joe Biden, the president, has had a stammer. And for people who are overcoming something, overcoming an accent or overcoming a stammer or overcoming a speech impediment, Amanda Gorman is something of a hero. And I think that she's this reference to Hamilton, just to shift gears a little bit, you know. Everyone should, the line from Miranda's play is, everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. We'll be safe in the nation we've made. That's the line that Miranda adds in. And after the anxiety and fear of a great and terrible event, an event that is so terrible that it shocks a whole nation, people are afraid. And so for people to say, be unafraid, be not afraid, right? Which is that beautiful beautiful phrase from the Bible, be not afraid. It's just a wonderful thing to hear. And we look to poets to give us light and direction at times like this. And then Gorman spins this line a little bit and more in her own poem. And she adds the sound that we're familiar with. If we're to live up to our own time, then victory won't lie in the blade, but in all the bridges we've made. And so now the aid sound keeps coming through and it's connecting to Miranda, and a lot is going on, and I'm getting my head full of ideas from this poem. And then we get the title of the poem coming up. That is the promise to glade, the hill we climb if only we dare. To glade is an unusual verb. I looked it up in the OED and it goes back to 1621. It means to cut an opening in the forest. And so we're going to cut an opening with this promise. And the hill we climb, I think may recall in the book of Matthew, Jesus says that Jerusalem on Mount Zion is a city on a hill. But I think it most refers to the mountaintop that Martin Luther King Jr. refers to when he says, I may not get to the mountaintop with you, in his last speech. And he somehow knew that he might be assassinated and die. The mountaintop is always a reference to Moses, who spoke from the mountaintop, and to Jesus, who spoke from a sermon on the mount. But Moses knew that he wouldn't be able to get to the promised land with his people. He could only lead them to the River Jordan, and he couldn't cross over. And so there's something about that, the hill we climb. Think of all the generations that have been climbing. And you can even think of Langston Hughes's wonderful speech, mother to son poem, where she says, but I keep climbing and I keep climbing. And the stairs are hard and they have nails sticking out of them. And I'm paraphrasing, but I keep climbing on. And so the hill we climb is a constant metaphor for African-Americans, for immigrants, and for people in America climbing up. You know, we struggle to get up the mountaintop, and not all of our ancestors will make it there with us. Some of them will work their whole lives so that we can have better lives. And that's the sort of Moses sort of role. And that's the Martin Luther King Jr. sort of role. And so that is the promise to glade, the hill we climb if only we dare.
Gorman then addresses the progress still to be made in American society, and even as far as we have come, we still have far to go.
And then she gets into some, I think, of the complex problems of our time. And the poem starts to call out these serious issues. She says, it's because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it. When I read this line, I really thought of Colin Kaepernick. You know, I think of him in Conscience, thinking about the national anthem, thinking about how America was still a slave-owning state when we sang about the rocket's red glare, thinking about there are some uncomfortable later verses of that Star-Spangled Banner. And I think, and you think about his position, and he specifically addressed Black Lives Matter with his kneeling. And he was specifically saying in his kneeling that it was an act of conscience. And it was strange that anybody took exception to it, because he actually asked a veteran. He said, "I'm thinking of sitting in the locker room during the anthem," Colin Kaepernick said. And the veteran told him, I think it was a Vietnam veteran, said to, or might have been a Gulf War veteran. He said, "Don't do that. You know, that's disrespectful. Instead, kneel. We kneel in church. Show people that you have a difference. You're not disrespecting the flag or the song, the Star Spangled Banner. If you kneel, you're just saying, let's have a conscience about it. Let's look at the past we've inherited, and let's take the steps so that we can repair it," as Amanda Gorman suggests. And so that's, you know, I mean, maybe she did not have that in her mind, and I might be reading that into it, but that's a sort of association that I make at that point in the poem. And I think it's important when you read a poem that you make associations. Then she says, and this is about the Capitol violence called, you know, the storm, the so-called storm. "We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it." It actually comes from the previous line, so let me read them all together. "It's because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it, would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated." And she does a half rhyme between succeeded and defeated. She has that sound, inherit, repair it, and share it. And she's talking specifically and very clearly about white supremacy and how some people are white supremacists and they don't want to share America with anybody who isn't white. And for me and for you and for a lot of people, that's antithetical to the idea of America, that's the opposite of what America is about, diversity and welcoming of the many nations of the world into this melting pot called America, right? That old idea. And so she then says that she's specifically talking about how the intention of the mob was to delay the Electoral College vote. And she says, "would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. They might have delayed the vote, but they would not have, but democracy would not have been defeated," she says. Now, that again recalls the idea, that wonderful MLK, Martin Luther King line from the letter from a Birmingham jail, that justice too long delayed is justice denied, you know, and you can hear it. While democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated. It also recalls a wonderful other line from Martin Luther King Jr., the moral arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. I may have paraphrased that a little bit, but that's a wonderful line. And she's talking about that. You can't stop the beat. You know, you can't stop the beat, to quote Hairspray. All right.
In the Langston Hughes poem, "I Too," Hughes made clear his time may be delayed, but his time was coming when he wrote the lines, "They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, 'Eat in the kitchen,' then."
But tomorrow I will sit at the table. So you keep, right, you can put it off today, but tomorrow it will happen. And so you can hear this in Langston Hughes. You can hear it in Martin Luther King Jr. when he says that their people told us to wait with the hardest obstacle of all. We've waited long enough. 300 years is long enough. And so that's the key. And then we come back to Hamilton again. She says, "In this truth, in this faith we trust. For while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. It is a faith in our own commitment to democracy that can never be defeated." And she repeats that concept of defeated again, and that came from the word succeeded, defeated, defeated. You hear the rhyme. But this line is so wonderful. "In this truth, in this faith we trust," instead of "in God we trust," that we the slogan on our menu, on our money, in this truth, in this faith we trust. "For while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. It is a faith in our own commitment to democracy that can never be defeated." So you might say, unlike the slogan on our money, she's saying that the faith in democracy is a profound faith that it guided our founding fathers and it's going to keep guiding us. And certainly In God We Trust is a nice idea too, but you want to keep that faith that democracy will be spread to everybody equally, that no one will be disenfranchised. And that's the faith that she wants to keep. And, you know, the line, "History has its eyes on us," you know, really, it comes from Miranda's wonderful Hamilton, where he says, "History has its eyes on you," which is a song that's sung in Hamilton.
The climax of the poem then brings together all of these moments, providing full historical context to the inauguration stage.
And now we're coming to the end of the poem, and it's getting to be very climactic at this point. We get another chiasmus. And this is probably the best chiasmus, the best "ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." Listen to this. "So while once we asked how could we possibly prevail over catastrophe, now we assert how could catastrophe possibly prevail over us." Let me read that again. "So while once we asked how could we possibly prevail over catastrophe, now we assert how could catastrophe possibly prevail over us." And so you can see "we, catastrophe, catastrophe, us." And it goes A to B, B to A. That's called a chiasmus. And that's wonderful. And here's probably the most musical line in the whole poem, this next line. "We will not be turned around or interrupted by intimidation, because we know our inaction and inertia will be the inheritance of the next generation, become the future." Now, this is like Emily Dickinson. She does something called a half rhyme, inertia and future. It's the way you say the word inertia, that it could sound like future. And she also rhymes intimidation and generation. Now, this is the sort of end of the speech. And, you know, like the end of a great speech, is it's almost a peroration, which is you sort of bring all your points together just before the end of the speech. And then there's a final conclusion. Now, for her peroration, she is going to do one of the most wonderful mashups. You know this tradition of mashups that we have in music today, where you hear part of one song mixed in with another, you know, that kind of thing. She's going to do this incredible mashup between Martin Luther King Jr.'s "I Have a Dream" speech and Maya Angelou's "Still I Rise," her famous "Still I Rise" poem. And it's these two sections in particular. The very end of MLK's I Have a Dream, I'll read just a little bit of this. He says, "And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true." This is Martin Luther King Jr., not Amanda Gorman. Listen to this. "And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring." The Stone Mountain, Georgia, was the home of the Ku Klux Klan, and Lookout Mountain was part of the Southern racist movement as well, the Klan movement. And Mississippi was where a lot of the great civil rights leaders were murdered: Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, and also people like Medgar Evers. So you've got all of these extraordinary things going on, and Martin Luther King Jr. is saying, "We're gonna, from the noble hills and from the not so noble hills, we are going to let freedom ring." And he has these beautiful descriptions. Then Maya Angelou writes in her poem, "Still I Rise," this is the end of her poem, "Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise up from a past that's rooted in pain. I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling. I bear it in the tide, leaving behind nights of terror and fear. I rise into a daybreak that's wondrously clear. I rise, bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise." That's Maya Angelou. So now this is how Gorman fuses the two of their voices together into one beautiful poetic fugue. And here it is. This is wonderful. Listen to this. "Every breath from my bronze pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the golden hills of the West. We will rise from the windswept Northeast, where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the Midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked South. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover, and every known nook of our nation and every corner called our country our people diverse and beautiful will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it, for there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it. And my association for the end of that line, and it's so beautiful, to make your dreams real, not to just leave them dreams. Well, I always think of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Don't dream it, be it. And that is the splendid poem that is Amanda Gorman's Hill We Climb.
Professor Duner also addressed if this poem may help to provide healing to a nation, which is still desperately politically divided.
I think so. I think it can help. You know, no one poem can heal a nation. I mean, many more people than saw her perhaps at the Super Bowl when she talked about the three symbolic captains of the Super Bowl that day, a nurse, a teacher, and a veteran who works with kids in a rough part of the city. And she spoke about these three captains at the Super Bowl, and she has this incredible confidence. And yet you have to remember her own history and how much she has conquered to come to that point. I think she is connecting with people. She's connecting those people. There's a whole vast tradition in churches across America and in Def Jam poetry slams that our academic professors don't know anything about, which is this live spoken word tradition. She is immediately hooking into all of that. She's connecting with as a powerful symbol, as a powerful role model, and for me, reviving the spirit of poetry, which has too long been sort of thought as a dusty old object that, you know, that you trot out and, you know, students groan when they hear it.
Much in the way the Broadway hit Hamilton invited many who had never listened to or seen a Broadway show before, Amanda Gorman's poetry may open the door for a new poetic spirit for new audiences in the United States.
There's a whole lot of hip people with hip playlists out there, and they're listening to Gil Scott-Heron's The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. I met 18-year-olds who are doing this, and they're listening to Saul Williams recite Def Jam poetry, and they're listening to Hamilton, and they're listening to, everything, you know, Tupac and KRS-One and all of these things. And there are voices out there that have been connected together by people like Eminem and by all sorts of speakers. And Amanda Gorman is going to add to that. And I think she is on the poet side, not so much the musician or hip hop side. And she's going to talk about the value of words themselves. And people are going to listen to that in particular. And so maybe you're not a music major, or maybe you don't know how to work a keyboard, but you can listen to the sound of her language, and maybe you can master language in the same way. I think it is the beginning of something, but it's also part of a movement that started way back in 1970. But it's also the beginning of something new that we can actually hope that will continue. I think we're going to need more voices like Lin-Manuel Miranda and Amanda Gorman to join together to create a more poetic nation. But I think about countries like Ireland, where their poets are part of the culture, where everybody knows who William Butler Yeats and Patrick Kavanagh are, you know, who they are, and they can quote them. And that's like regular people at a bar can quote a poem in Ireland. And will America gain this poetic spirit? Well, America used to have this love of rhetoric and love of words. Everybody memorized the Gettysburg Address at one point in history. We used to love learning things like the Friends, Romans, Countrymen speech from Julius Caesar. And I think we can restore that, because it's an age where people are playing with words all the time in ephemeral and shallow ways in social media. But poetry is being created on TikTok all the time. And poetry is being, you know, I mean, even in 2-second poetry, right? In blurbs and in YouTube, in content on YouTube. And poetry is being created in spoken word. And I think what we need is people like us in academia to validate it a little bit more. And I think we need more people pointing the finger that this is the way to go. But I think something might be happening. I hope that more people listen to her. I want her career to be long. I want people, I can't wait to see what she does next. I want to see people across America, all races, connect to Amanda Gorman And I want her to be the new Robert Frost. Absolutely. I want more Amanda Gormans. I want voices to come out that may not have been heard yet. And I want I want this living tradition to bloom completely.
We would like to sincerely thank Professor Steve Dooner of Quincy College for his insightful and thoughtful analysis of Amanda Gorman's poem, The Hill We Climb, as JFY continues to celebrate Black History Month. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources, including this monthly podcast, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.